situation with Victor Madden. When he thought Appius Livius was up to speed on the Felipe de Castro-Victor Madden situation, Eric asked him, "How did you come to be on hand for the rescue of this young man?" Eric smiled at Alexei. This would be a story worth listening to, now that I'd heard Alexei's horrifying tale about salting his grave. While Alexei Romanov sat by his side in remote silence, Appius told Eric about tracking down the Russian royal family in 1918.
"Though I had expected something of the sort, I had to move much faster than I had anticipated," Appius said.
He finished his bottled blood.
"The decision to execute them was made so swiftly, conducted at such speed, no one wanted the men to have time to think twice about it. For many of the soldiers, it was a terrible thing they were doing."
"Why did you want to save the Romanovs?"
Eric asked, as if Alexei weren't there. And Appius Livius laughed. He gave great laugh.
"I hated the fucking Bolsheviks," he said, "and I had a tie to the boy. Rasputin had been giving him my blood for years. I happened to be in Russia already. You remember the St. Petersburg massacre?"
Eric nodded.
"I do indeed. I had not seen you in many years and only caught a glimpse of you then."
Eric had talked about the St. Petersburg massacre before. A vampire named Gregory had had madness visited on him by a vengeful Maenad, and it had taken 20 vampires to pin him down and then disguise the results.
"After that night, when so many of us worked together to tidy up the scene after Gregory was subdued, I developed a fondness for the Russian vampires, and the Russian people, too."
He tacked the Russian people on with a gracious nod toward me and Jason as representatives of the human race.
"The fucking Bolsheviks killed so many of us. I was grieved. The deaths of Fyodor and Velislava were particularly hard. They were both great vampires, and hundreds of years old."
"I knew them,"
Eric said.
"I sent them a message to get out before I started to look for the royal family. I could track Alexei because he'd had my blood. Rasputin knew what we were. Whenever the Empress would call him to heal the boy when the hemophilia was very bad, Rasputin would beg some of my blood and the boy would recover. I heard a rumor they were thinking of killing the royal family, and I began following the scent of my blood. When I set out to rescue them, you can imagine how like a crusader I felt."
They both laughed, and I suddenly understood that the two vampires had actually seen crusaders, the original Christian knight crusaders. When I tried to comprehend how old they were, how much they'd witnessed, how many experiences they'd had that almost no one else walking the earth remembered, it made my head hurt.
"Sook, you got the most interesting company,"
Jason said.
"Listen, I know you want to go, but if you could stick around for a while, I'd appreciate it,"
I said. I wasn't happy with having Eric's maker and the poor child Alexei here, and since Alexei was clearly happy with Jason, his presence might help ease this uncomfortable situation.
"I'll just go put the table out in the truck and call Michelle," he said. "Alexei, you won't come with me?"
Appius Livius didn't move, but he definitely grew tense. Alexei looked over at the ancient Roman. After a long pause, Appius Livius nodded at the boy.
"Alexei, remember your company manners,"
Appius Livius said softly. Alexei bobbed his head. Having been given permission, the Tsarevich of Russia went outside with the road crew worker to stow a table in the back of a pickup. When I was alone with Eric and his maker, I felt a stab of anxiety. Actually, it was flowing right through the bond I had with Eric. I wasn't the only one around here who was worried, and their conversation appeared to be at a standstill.
"Excuse me, Appius Livius," I said carefully. "Since you were in the right empire at the right time, I wonder if you ever saw Jesus."
The Roman was staring at the hallway, willing Alexei to reappear.
"The carpenter? No, I didn't see him,"
Appius said, and I could tell he was making an effort to be courteous.
"The Jew died right around the time I was changed. As you will appreciate, I had many other things to think of. In fact, I didn't hear the whole myth until sometime later when the world began to change as a result of his death.
That would really have been amazing, talking to a creature who'd seen the living God, even if he called him a myth. And I went back to fearing the Roman, not for what he'd done to me, or what he'd done to Eric, or even what he was doing to Alexei, but for what he might do to all of us if he took a mind to. I had always tried to find the good in people, but the best I could say of Appius was that he had good taste in those he picked to become vampires. While I brooded, Appius was explaining to Eric how conveniently it had worked out in the cellar in Yekaterinburg. Alexei had almost bled out from his wounds, so he'd given the boy a big gulp of his blood, moving at super speed and therefore invisible to the execution squad. Then he'd watched from the shadows while the bodies were thrown down a well. The next day, the royal family was dug up again since the murderers feared the uproar that might follow the deaths of the Romanovs.
"I followed them the minute the sun set the next day," Appius said. "They'd stopped to rebury them, Alexei and one of his sisters."
"Maria," Alexei said softly, and I jumped. He had reappeared silently in the living room, standing behind Appius's chair. "It was Maria." There was a silence. Appius looked hugely relieved.
"Yes, of course, dear boy," Appius said, and he did manage to sound as though he cared. "Your sister Maria was completely gone, but there was a tiny spark in you."
Alexei put his hand on Appius Livius's shoulder, and Appius Livius reached up to pat him.
"Dad shot him many times," he explained to Eric. "Twice in the head. I put my blood directly in the bullet holes."
He turned his head to look at the boy behind him.
"My blood worked well, since you had lost so much of yours."
It was like he was recollecting happy times.
"Who, boy?"
The Roman turned back to look at Eric and me, and he smiled proudly. But I could see Alexei's face. Appius Livius genuinely felt that he'd been a savior to Alexei. I wasn't so sure Alexei was totally convinced of that.
"Where's your brother?"
Appius Livius suddenly asked, and I pushed to my feet to go find him. I had put two and two together, and I understood that Eric's maker wanted to be sure Alexei hadn't drained Jason and left him out in the yard. Jason came into the living room just then, slipping his cell phone into his pocket. He narrowed his eyes. Jason was not a nuanced kind of guy, but he could tell when I was unhappy.
"Sorry," he said, "talking to Michelle."
"Hmm," I said. I made a mental note that Appius Livius was worried about Alexei being alone with humans, and I knew that should scare me quite a bit. The night was growing older, and I had things to find out.
"I hate to change the subject, but there are a few things I need to know."
"What, Sookie?"
Eric asked, looking directly at me for the first time since old Master had popped up. He was pouring caution down the bond between us.
"I just have a couple of questions," I said, smiling as sweetly as I could. "Have you been in this area for any length of time?"
I met the ancient dark eyes again. It was hard to take Appius all in somehow. I found I couldn't look at him as a cohesive individual. He scared the shit out of me.
"No," he said mildly, "we have not. We've come here from the southwest, from Oklahoma, and we have only just arrived in Louisiana."
"So you wouldn't know anything about the new body buried at the back of my land?"
"No, nothing. Would you like us to go dig it up? Unpleasant, but doable. You are wanting to see who it is?"
That was an unexpected offer. Eric was looking at me very oddly.
"I'm sorry, honey," I told him. "I was trying to tell you when our unexpected guest showed up."
"Not Debbie," he said.
"No, Heidi says there's a new burial, but we do need to know who it is, and we need to find out who put it there."
"The Wares," Eric said instantly. "This is the thanks you get for letting them use your land. I'll call Alcide and we'll have a meeting."
Eric looked positively delighted to get the chance to do something boss-like. He whipped out his cell phone and dialed Alcide before I could say anything.
"Eric,"
he said into the phone by way of identification.
Alcide, we have to talk.
I could hear the buzz on the other end of the line. A moment later, Eric said,
That's not good, Alcide. I am sorry to hear you have troubles, but I have other concerns. What did you do on Sookie's land?
Oh, crapanola.
You should come here and see, then. I think some of your people have been bad. Very well, then. I'll see you in 10 minutes. I am at her house.
He hung up, looking triumphant.
Alcide was in Bonton? I asked.
No, but he was on the interstate and nearly at our exit, Eric explained. He's returning from some meeting in Monroe. The Louisiana PACs are trying to present a united front to the government. Since they've never organized before, this is not going to work.
Eric snorted, clearly scornful.
The wares are always... What did you say the other day about FEMA, Sookie? A day late and a dollar short, right? At least he's close, and when he gets here, we'll get to the bottom of this.
I sighed, trying to make it discreet and silent. I hadn't realized things would go so far so fast. I asked Eric, Appius Livius, and Alexei if they wanted more True Blood, but they turned it down. Jason was looking bored. I glanced at the clock.
I'm afraid I have only one spot that's suitable for a vampire. Where are you all planning to sleep come the dawn? I just want to know in case I need to call around and find a place.
Sookie, said Eric gently, I will take Okella and his son back to my house. They can have the guest coffins there.
Eric ordinarily slept in his bed because his bedroom was windowless. There were a couple of other coffins in the guest bedroom, sleek fiberglass things that looked sort of like kayaks, which he kept stowed under the beds. The most wrong thing about Alexei and Appius Livius staying with Eric was that if they were there, I was definitely staying here.
I think your darling would love to come in during the day and sink a stake into our chests, Appius Livius said, as if that were a big joke. If you think you can do it, young woman, you are welcome to try.
Oh, not at all, I said, absolutely insincerely. I wouldn't dream of doing such a thing to Eric's dad. Not a bad idea, though. Beside me, Eric twitched all over. It was a funny movement, like a dog running in its sleep.
Be polite, he told me, and there was no element of fun in his voice at all. He was giving me an order.
I took a deep breath. It was on the tip of my tongue to rescind Eric's invitation to my house. He'd have to leave, and presumably Appius Livius and Alexei would too. It was that, presumably, that stopped me. The idea of being alone with Appius Livius, even for a second, trumped the pleasurable vision of the three vampires walking out backward. It was probably lucky for all of us that the doorbell rang then. I was out of my seat as if a rocket had fired me. It would be good to have more breathers around. Alcide was wearing a suit. He was flanked by Annabelle, who was wearing a dark green sheath and heeled pumps, and Janilyn, Sam's new interest. Janilyn had a sense of style, though it was a style that left me stunned. She had on a shiny silver dress that barely covered her assets and silver high-heeled sandals that laced up the front. The silver eyeshadow over her heavily outlined eyes completed the look. In a scary kind of way, she looked great. Sam certainly dated women who were extraordinary in some way, and he wasn't afraid of strong characters, which was a thought I'd have to save for later. Maybe it was a two-natured thing? Alcide was the same way. I gave the pack leader a hug, and I said hello to Annabelle and to Janilyn, who gave me a curt nod.
What is this problem Eric called me about?
Alcide was saying as I stood aside to let them enter. When the wares realized they were in a room with three vampires, all of them tensed. They'd expected only Eric. When I glanced back at the vampires, I saw they were all standing too, and even Alexei was on the alert. Jason said,
Alcide, good to see you. Ladies, looking mighty fine tonight.
I went into high gear.
Hi, you all, I said brightly. It was so nice of you to come on such short notice. Eric, you know Alcide. Alcide, this is Eric's longtime friend, Appius Livius Okella, who's in town visiting with his, protege, Alexei. Eric, I don't know if you've met Alcide's friend Annabelle, a new pack member, and Janilyn, who's been in the Longtooth pack for ages. Janilyn, we've never had a chance to talk much, but of course Sam talks about you all the time, and I think you all know my brother, Jason.
Phew, I felt like I'd run an introduction marathon.
Since vamps don't shake hands, that concluded the opening ceremonies. Then I had to get them all to sit down while I offered them drinks, which no one accepted. Eric fired the opening volley.
Alcide, one of my trackers, went over Suki's land after Basim al-Saud warned her about the strangers he smelled in her woods. Our tracker has found a new body buried there.
Alcide looked at Eric as though he had begun speaking in tongues.
We didn't kill anyone that night, Alcide said. Basim said he told Suki we smelled an old body, and a fairy or two, and a vampire, but he didn't mention a fresh body.
Yet there's a new burial there now.
Which we had nothing to do with.
Alcide shrugged.
We were there 3 nights before your tracker smelled the scent of a fresh body.
It seems quite a huge coincidence, doesn't it?
A body on Suki's land, right after your pack is there?
Eric was looking aggravatingly reasonable.
Maybe it's more of a coincidence that there was already a body on Suki's land.
Oh, boy, I really didn't want to go there. Janilyn was actually snarling at Eric. It was an interesting look, with the eye makeup and all. Annabelle was standing with her arms slightly away from her body, waiting to see which way she needed to jump. Alexei was staring off into space, which seemed to be his fallback stance, and Appius Livius simply seemed bored.
I say we should go see who it is,
Jason said unexpectedly. I looked at him with approval. So out we went, into the woods, to dig up a corpse. Chapter 9 Alcide changed to some boots he had in the truck, and he shed his tie and coat. Janilyn wisely took off her spike-heeled sandals, and Annabelle her own more modest heels. I gave them both some sneakers of mine, and I offered Janilyn an old t-shirt to cover her shiny silver dress so it wouldn't snag in the woods. She pulled it over her head. She even said, "Thanks," though she didn't sound actually grateful. I retrieved 2 shovels from the tool shed. Alcide took 1 shovel, Eric the other. Jason carried one of those great big flashlights called a lantern that he'd fished out of the toolbox on his truck. The lantern was for my benefit. The vampires could see perfectly well in the dark, and the weres could see very well, too. Since Jason was a werepanther, he had excellent night vision. I was the blind one in the group.
"Do we know where we're going?"
Annabelle said. "Heidi said it was due east, close to the stream, in a clearing," I said, and we slogged eastward. I kept running into stuff, and after a while, Eric handed off his shovel to Jason and crouched so I could cling to his back. I kept my head tucked behind his so branches wouldn't hit me in the face. Our progress was smoother after that.
"I smell it,"
Janilyn said suddenly. She was out ahead of us all, as if her job in the pack were to make the way clear for the pack leader. She was a different woman out in the woods. Though I couldn't see very well, I could see that. She was quick, sure-footed, and decisive. She darted ahead, and after a moment she called back, "Here it is!" We got there to find her standing over a patch of dirt in a little clearing. It had been disturbed recently, though an attempt had been made to camouflage that disturbance. Eric eased me down onto the ground, and Jason shone the lantern at the earth.
"It's not,"
I whispered, knowing everyone there could hear me.
"No,"
Eric said firmly.
"Too recent."
"Not Debbie Pelt. She was elsewhere, in an older grave."
"Only one way to find out who it is,"
Alcide said. Jason and Alcide began to dig, and since they were both very strong, it went quickly. Alexei came over to stand by me, and it occurred to me that a grave in the woods had to be a bad flashback for him. I put an arm around him, as if he were still human, though I noticed that Appius gave me a sardonic look. Alexei's eyes were on the gravediggers, especially Jason. I knew this child could dig the grave with his bare hands as fast as they were digging with shovels, But Alexei looked so frail, it was hard to think of him being as strong as other vampires. I wondered how many people had made that mistake in the past few decades, and how many of those had died at Alexei's small hands. Jason and Alcee could make the dirt fly. While they worked, Annabelle and Janilyn prowled around the little clearing, probably trying to pick up what scents they could. Despite the rain of 2 nights ago, there might be something in the areas protected by the trees. Heidi hadn't been looking for a murderer. She'd been trying to make a list of who'd crossed the land. I was thinking that the only creatures who hadn't been tromping through my woods had been regular old humans. If the wares were lying, a were could be the killer. Or it could be one of the Fae, who were a violent race, as I had observed. Or the killer could be Bill, since Heidi thought the vampire she'd scented was my neighbor. I hadn't smelled the body while it was under the dirt, as the others had, since my sense of smell was only a fraction of theirs. But as the dirt piles grew and the hole got deeper, I could tell it was there. Oh, gosh, could I? I put my hand across my nose, which didn't help at all. I couldn't imagine how the others were enduring it, since it would be so much sharper to their senses. Maybe they were also more practical, or simply more accustomed. Then both the diggers stopped. "He's wrapped up," Jason said. Alcide bent over and fumbled with something at the bottom of the hole. "I think I got it pulled apart," Alcide said after a moment. "Pass me the lantern, Sookie," Jason said, and I tossed it to him. He shone it down. "I don't know this man," he said.
"I do," said Alcide in a strange voice.
Annabelle and Janilyn were at the edge of the grave instantly. I had to brace myself to step forward to look down into the pit. I recognized him instantly. The three wares threw back their heads and howled. "It's the Longtooth Enforcer," I told the vampires. I gagged and had to wait a minute before I could go on. "It's Basim al-Saud." The passage of days had made a great difference, but I knew him instantly. Those corkscrew curls I'd envied, the muscled body.
"Shit!" screamed Janilyn when the howling was done, and that about summed it up.
When the wares had calmed down, there was a lot to talk about. "I only met him the once," I said. "Of course, he was fine when he got in the truck with Alcide and Annabelle."
"He told me what he'd smelled on the property, and I told him to tell Sookie," Alcide told Eric. "She had a right to know. We didn't talk about anything in particular on the way back to Shreveport, did we, Annabelle?"
"No," she said, and I could tell she was crying.
"I dropped him off at his apartment. When I called him the next day to go with me to a meeting with our representative, he said he had to pass because he had to work. He was a website designer, and he had a meeting with an important client. I wasn't too happy he couldn't go, but of course, the guy had to make a living."
Alcide shrugged. Annabelle said,
"He didn't have to work that day."
There was a moment of silence.
"I was at his apartment when you called," she said, and I could tell the effort she was expending to keep her voice calm and level. "I'd been there a few hours."
Wow. Unexpected revelation. Jason had hopped out of the grave, and he and I gave each other big eyes. This was like one of Gran's stories, the soap operas she'd watched religiously. Alcide growled. The ritual howling for the dead had brought out the wolf in him.
"I know," Annabelle said, "and we'll talk about it later. I'll take my punishment, which I deserve. But Basim's death is more important than my bad judgment. This is my duty to tell you what happened. Basim got a phone call before yours, and he didn't want me to hear it. But I heard enough to understand his conversation was with someone who was paying him."
Alcide's growl intensified. Janilyn was standing close to her pack sister, and the only way I can put it was that she was aimed at Annabelle. She was crouching slightly, her hands curved as if they were about to sprout claws. Alexei had edged close to Jason, and when the tension kept ratcheting up, Jason's arm slung around the boy's shoulders. Jason was having the same problem separating illusion and reality that I was. Annabelle flinched at the sound coming from Alcide, but she kept on going.
"So Basim made up an excuse to get me out of the apartment, and he took off. I tried to follow him, but I lost him."
You were suspicious, Janilyn said. But you didn't call the Packmaster. You didn't call me. You didn't call anyone. We took you in and made you a member of our pack, and you betrayed us. Suddenly, she hit Annabelle in the head with her fist, actually leaping into the air to land the blow. Just like that, Annabelle was on the ground. I gasped, and I wasn't the only one. But I was the only one who noticed that Jason was straining to hold Alexei back. Something about the violence in the air had sent the boy over the edge. If he'd been a little bigger, Jason would have been on the ground. I punched Eric in the arm, jerked my head in the direction of the struggle. Eric leaped over to help Jason restrain the boy, who fought and snarled in their arms. For a moment, there was silence in the dark clearing as everyone watched Alexei struggle with his madness. Appius Livius looked profoundly sad. He worked his way into the knot of limbs and wrapped his own arms around his child.
"Shh," he said, "my son, be still."
And gradually, Alexei grew quiet. Alcide's voice was very close to a rumble when he said,
"Janilyn, you are my new second. Annabelle, get up. This is pack business now, and we'll settle it at the pack meeting."
He turned his back on us and began moving. The Wares were simply going to walk out of the woods and drive away. "Excuse me?" I said sharply. "There's the little matter of the body being buried on my land. I think there's something pretty damn significant about that." The Wares stopped walking. Eric said,
"Yes." The one word carried a lot of weight. "Alcide, I believe Sookie and I need to sit in on your pack meeting."
"Only pack members," Janilyn snapped. "No oneies, no deaders."
She was still as small as ever, but with her field promotion to second, she seemed harder and stronger in spirit. She was a ruthless little thing, no doubt about it. I thought Sam was mighty brave, or mighty foolish.
"Alcide," Eric said quietly.
"Sookie can bring Jason, since he's two-natured," Alcide growled. "She's a oney, but she's a friend of the pack. No vamps."
Eric glanced at my brother.
"Jason, will you accompany your sister?"
"Sure,"
Jason said. So it was settled. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw Annabelle stagger to her feet and reorient herself. Janilyn packed a wallop.
"What are you going to do with the body?"
I called after Alcide, who was definitely moving out.
"Do you want us to cover him back up or what?"
Annabelle took a hesitant step after Janilyn and Alcide. That was going to be a happy ride back to Shreveport.
"Someone will come get him tonight," Janilyn called over her shoulder. "So there'll be activity in your woods. Don't be alarmed."
When Annabelle glanced back, I noticed she was bleeding from one corner of her mouth. I felt the vampires come to attention. In fact, Alexei stepped away from Jason and would have followed her if Appius Livius hadn't kept his grip on the boy.
"Should we cover him back up?"
Jason said. "If they're sending a crew to get him, that seems like wasted effort," I said. "Eric, I'm so glad you sent Heidi. Otherwise..." I thought hard.
"Listen, if he was buried on my land, it was so he could be found here, right? So there's no telling when someone's gonna get a tip to come looking for him."
The only one who seemed to follow my reasoning was Jason, who said,
"Okay, we gotta get him out of here."
I was flapping my hands in the air. I was so anxious.
"We've gotta put him somewhere," I said. "We could just set him in the cemetery."
"Nah, too close," Jason said.
"What about the pond behind your house?" I said.
"Nah, damn it, the fish. I could never eat those fish again."
"Ugh,"
I said.
"Really?"
"Is your time with her usually like this?"
Appius Livius asked Eric, who was smart enough not to answer.
"Sookie," he said, "it won't be pleasant, but I think I can fly carrying him if you can suggest a good place to put him."
I felt like my brain was running through a maze and hitting all the dead ends. I actually smacked myself on the side of the head to jog an idea loose. It worked.
"Sure, Eric. Put him in the woods right across the road from my driveway. There's a little bit of a driveway left there, but no house. The Wares can use the driveway as a marker when they come to retrieve him, 'cause someone's coming to find him and coming soon."
Without further discussion, Eric leaped into the hole and rewrapped Basim in the sheet, or whatever the wrapping was.
Though the lantern showed me his face was full of disgust, he scooped up the decomposing body and leaped into the air. He was out of view in a second.
Damn, said Jason, impressed. Cool.
Let's fill in this grave, I said.
We set to work, with Appius Livius watching. It obviously didn't occur to him that his help would make the job go much faster. Even Alexei shoved in piles of dirt, and he seemed to be having a pretty good time doing it. This was probably as close to a normal activity as the 13-year-old had come in some time. Gradually, the hole filled in. It still looked like a grave. The Tsarevich tore at the hard edges with his small hands. I almost protested, but then I saw what he was doing. He reconfigured the grave-shaped dent until it looked like an irregular dent, maybe created by rain or a collapsed mole tunnel. He beamed at us when he'd finished, and Jason clapped him on the back. Jason got a branch and swept it over the area, and then we tossed leaves and branches around. Alexei enjoyed that part, too. Finally, we gave up. I couldn't think of one more thing to do. Filthy and frightened, I shouldered one of the shovels and prepared to make my way through the woods. Jason took the other shovel in his right hand, and Alexei took Jason's left hand, as if he were even younger than the child he looked. My brother, though his face was a picture, kept hold of the vampire. Appius Livius at last made himself useful by leading us through the trees and undergrowth with some assurance. Eric was at the house when we reached it. He'd already thrown his clothes into the garbage and gotten into the shower. Under other circumstances, I would have loved to join him, but it just wasn't possible to feel sexy at the moment. I was grimy and nasty, but I was still the hostess, so I heated up some more True Blood for the two visiting vampires and showed them the downstairs bathroom in case they wanted to wash up. Jason came into the kitchen to tell me that he was going to shove off.
Let me know when the meeting is, he said in a subdued way, and I gotta report all this to Calvin, you know.
I understand, I said, weary to death of politics of all kinds. I wondered if America knew what it was in for when it considered requiring the two nature to register. America was really better off not having to go through this crap. Human politics were tedious enough.
Jason went out the back door. A second later, I heard his truck roaring away. Almost as soon as Appius Livius and Alexei had had their drinks, Eric came out of my bedroom in fresh clothes. He kept a change at my house, and smelling very much like my apricot body wash. With his maker around, Eric could hardly have a heart-to-heart with me, assuming he wanted to. He wasn't exactly acting like my honey now that his dad was in the house. There could be several reasons for this. I didn't like any of them. Soon afterward, the three vampires left for Shreveport. Appius Livius thanked me for my hospitality in such an impassive way that I had no idea whether he was being sarcastic. Eric was as silent as a stone. Alexei, as calm and smiling as if he'd never gone mad, gave me a cold embrace. I had a hard time accepting it with equal calm. 3 seconds after they were out the door, I was on the phone.
Fantasia, where all your bloody dreams come true, said a bored female voice.
Pam, listen.
The phone is pressed to my ear. Speak.
Appius Livius Okella just dropped in.
Fuck a zombie!
I wasn't sure that I'd heard that correctly.
Yes, he's been here. I guess he's your granddad? Anyway, he's got a new protege with him, and they're heading for Eric's to spend the day.
What does he want?
He hasn't said yet.
How is Eric?
Very tightly wound, plus a lot of stuff happened that he'll tell you about.
Thanks for the warning. I'll go to the house now. You're my favorite breather.
Oh, well, great.
She hung up. I wondered what preparations she would make. Would the vamps and humans who worked at the Shreveport nightclub go into a cleaning frenzy at Eric's? I'd only seen Pam and Bobby Burnham there, though I assumed some of the crew came in from time to time. Would Pam rush some willing humans over to act as bedtime snacks?
I was too tense to think about going to bed.
Whatever Eric's maker was doing here, it wasn't something I was going to like.
And I already knew Appius Livius's presence was bad for our relationship. While I was in the shower,
And before I picked up the wet towels Eric had left on the floor, I did some serious thinking. Vampire plotting can be pretty convoluted, but I tried to imagine the significance of the Roman's surprise visit. Surely he hadn't shown up in America, in Louisiana, in Shreveport, just to catch up on the geezer gossip. Maybe he needed a loan. That wouldn't be too bad. Eric could always make more money. Though I had no idea how Eric stood financially. I had a little nest egg in the bank since Sophie Ann's estate had paid up the money she'd owed me, and whatever Claudine had had in her checking account would be coming to join it. If Eric needed it, he could have it. But what if money wasn't the issue? Maybe Appius Livius needed to hole up because he'd gotten in trouble somewhere else. Maybe some Bolshevik vampires were after Alexei. That would be interesting. I could always hope they'd catch up with Appius Livius as long as it wasn't at Eric's house. Or perhaps Eric's maker had been courted by Felipe de Castro or Victor Madden because they wanted something from Eric that he hadn't given up yet, and they planned on using Eric's maker to pull his strings. But here was my most likely scenario. Appius Livius Ocella had dropped by with his new boy toy just to mess with Eric's head. That was the guess I was putting my money on. Appius Livius was hard to read. At moments, he seemed okay. He seemed to care about Eric, and he seemed to care about Alexei. As for Eric's maker's relationship with Alexei, the boy would have died if Appius Livius hadn't intervened. Given the circumstances, Alexei's witnessing the murders of his entire family and their servants and friends, letting the Tsarevich die might have been a blessing. I was sure Appius Livius was having sex with Alexei, but it was impossible to tell whether Alexei's passive demeanor came from the fact that he was in an unwanted sexual relationship or from his being permanently traumatized from seeing his family shot multiple times. I shuddered. I dried off and brushed my teeth, hoping I could sleep. I realized there was another phone call I should make. With great reluctance, I called Bobby Burnham, Eric's daytime guy. Bobby and I had never liked each other. Bobby was weirdly jealous of me, though he didn't have the hots for Eric sexually at all. In Bobby's opinion, I diverted Eric's attention and energy away from its proper focus, which was Bobby and the business affairs he handled for Eric while Eric slept the day away. I was down on Bobby because instead of silently disliking me, he actively tried to make my life more difficult, which was a whole different kettle of fish. But still, we were both in the Eric business.
Bobby, it's Sookie.
I got caller ID.
Mr. Sullen.
Bobby, I think you ought to know that Eric's maker is in town. When you go over to get your instructions, be careful.
Bobby normally got briefed right before Eric went to ground for the day, unless Eric stayed over at my place. Bobby took his time with his reply, probably trying to figure out if I was playing some elaborate practical joke on him.
Is he likely to want to bite me? He asked. The maker?
I don't know what he's gonna want, Bobby. I just felt like I ought to give you a heads up.
Eric won't let him hurt me, Bobby said confidently.
Just as general information, if this guy says jump, Eric has to ask how high.
No way, Bobby said.
To Bobby, Eric was the most powerful creature under the moon.
Way, they gotta mind their maker. This is no lie.
Bobby had to have heard that news item before. I know there's some kind of website or message board for vampires' human assistance. I'm sure they swap all kinds of handy hints about dealing with their employers. Whatever the reason, Bobby didn't argue or accuse me of trying to deceive him, which was a nice change.
Okay, he said. I'm ready for him. What kind of person is Eric's maker?
He's not much like a person at all anymore, I said. And he's got a 13-year-old boyfriend who used to be Russian royalty.
After a long silence, Bobby said,
Thanks. It's good to be prepared.
That was the nicest thing he'd ever said to me.
You're welcome. Good night, Bobby,
I said, and we hung up. We'd managed to have an entire civil conversation. Vampires bringing America together. I changed into a nightshirt and crawled into bed. I had to try to get some sleep, but it took its own sweet time coming.
I kept seeing the light from the lantern dance across the clearing in the woods as the dirt mounded up around the edges of Basim's grave. And I saw the dead ware's face. But eventually, finally, the edges of that face blurred, and darkness slid over me. I slept late and heavily the next day. The minute I woke, I knew someone was in the kitchen cooking. I let my extra sense check it out, and I found that Claude was frying bacon and eggs. There was coffee in the pot, and I didn't need telepathy to know that. I could smell it, the perfume of morning. After a trip to the bathroom, I stumbled into the hall and made my way into the kitchen. Claude was sitting at the table eating, and I could see there was enough coffee in the pot for me. "There's food," he said, pointing to the stove. I got a plate and a mug and settled in for a good start to my day. I glanced over at the clock. It was Sunday, and Merlot's wouldn't be open until the afternoon. Sam was trying Sundays again in a limited way, though the whole staff hoped it wouldn't be profitable. As Claude and I ate in companionable silence, I realized I felt wonderfully peaceful because Eric was in his day sleep. That meant I didn't have to feel him walking around with me. His problematic sire and his new brother were out of it, too. I sighed with relief.
"I saw Dermot last night," Claude said.
"Crap.
Well, so much for peace."
"Where?"
I asked. "He was at the club, staring at me with longing," Claude said.
"Dermot's gay?"
"No, I don't think so. It was my dick he was thinking of. He wanted to be around another fairy."
"I sure hoped he was gone. Niall told Jason and me that Dermot helped kill my parents. I wish he'd gone into the Feyland when it was closing up."
"He would have been killed on sight." Claude took the time to sip some coffee before he added, "No one in the Fey world understands Dermot's actions. He should have sided with Niall from the beginning, because he's kin, and because he's half-human, and Niall wanted to spare humans. But his own self-loathing, or at least that's all I can imagine, led him to take the side of the fairies who really couldn't stand him, and that side lost."
Claude looked happy.
"So Dermot has cut off his own nose to spite his face. I love that saying. Sometimes humans put things very well."
"Do you think he still means to hurt my brother and me?"
"I don't think he ever intended to hurt you," Claude said, after thinking it over. "I think Dermot is crazy, though he used to be an agreeable guy a few score years ago. I don't know if it's his human side that's gone batshit, or his fae side that's soaked up too many toxins from the human world. I can't even explain his part in killing your parents. The Dermot I used to know would never have done such a thing."
I considered pointing out that truly crazy people can hurt others around them without meaning to, or without even realizing they're doing it. But I didn't. Dermot was my great-uncle, and according to everyone who'd met him, he was nearly a dead ringer for my brother. I admitted to myself I was curious about him, and I wondered about what Niall had said about Dermot having been the one who'd opened the truck doors so my parents could be pulled out and drowned by Niamh and Lachlan. Dermot's behavior, the bit that I'd observed, didn't jibe with the horror of that incident. Would Dermot think of me as kin? Were Jason and I fey enough to attract him? I had doubted Bill's assertion that he felt better from my nearness because of my fairy blood. "Claude, can you tell I'm not entirely human? How do I register on the fairy meter?" "Fadar."
"If you were in a crowd of humans, I could pick you out blindfolded and say you're my kin," Claude said without hesitation. "But if you were in the middle of the fey, I would call you human. It's an elusive scent. Most vamps would think, 'She smells good,' and they'd enjoy being close to you. That would be the extent of it. Once they know you have fairy blood, they can attribute that enjoyment to it."
So Bill really could be comforted by my little streak of fey, at least now that he knew how to identify it. I got up to rinse off my plate and pour another mugful of coffee, and in passing I grabbed Claude's empty plate, too. He didn't thank me. "I appreciate your cooking," I said. "We haven't talked about how we'll handle grocery expenses or household items."
Claude looked surprised. "I hadn't thought about it," he said.
"Well, at least that was honest." "I'll tell you how Amelia and I did it," I said, and in a few sentences I laid out the guidelines. Looking a little stunned, Claude agreed. I opened the refrigerator.
These two shelves are yours, I said, and the rest are mine.
I get it, he said.
Somehow I doubted that. Claude sounded like he was simply trying to give the impression that he understood and agreed. There was a good chance we'd have to have this conversation again. When he'd left to go upstairs, I took care of the dishes, after all he'd cooked, and after I got dressed, I thought I'd read for a while, but I was too restless to concentrate on my book. I heard cars coming down the driveway through the woods. I looked out the front window. Two police cars. I'd been sure this was coming, but my heart sank down to my toes. Sometimes I hated being right. Whoever had killed Basim had planted his body on my land to implicate me in his death. Claude, I called up the stairs. Get decent if you're not. The police are here. Claude, curious as ever, came down the stairs at a trot. He was wearing jeans and a t-shirt like me. We went out on the front porch. Bud Dearborn, the sheriff, the regular human sheriff, was in the first car, and Andy Belfleur and Alcee Beck were in the second. The sheriff and two detectives. I must be a dangerous criminal. Bud got out of his car slowly, the way he did most things these days. I knew from his thoughts that Bud was increasingly a victim to arthritis, and he had some doubts about his prostate, too. Bud's mashed-in face didn't give any hint about his physical discomfort as he came up to the porch, his heavy belt creaking with the weight of all the things hanging from it. Bud, what's up? I asked. Not that I'm not glad to see you all.
Sookie, we got an anonymous phone call, Bud said. As you know, law enforcement couldn't solve much without anonymous tips, but I personally don't respect a person who won't tell you who they are.
I nodded.
Who's your friend?
Andy asked. He looked worn. I'd heard his grandmother, who'd raised him, was on her deathbed. Poor Andy. He'd much rather be there than here. Alcee Beck, the other detective, really didn't like me. He never had, and his dislike had found a good foundation to settle on. His wife had been attacked by a ware who was trying to get to me. Even though I'd taken the guy out, Alcee was down on me. Maybe he was one of the rare people repulsed by my trace of fairy blood, but more likely he just didn't care for me. There was no point in trying to win him over. I gave him a nod, which he did not return.
This here's my cousin Claude Crane from Monroe, I said.
How's he related?
Andy asked. All three of these men knew the skein of blood ties that bound together practically the whole parish.
It's kind of embarrassing,
Claude said. Nothing would embarrass Claude, but he gave a good imitation.
I'm from what you call the wrong side of the blanket.
For once, I was grateful to Claude for taking that weight. I cast my eyes down as though I couldn't bear to talk about the shame of it.
Claude and I are trying to get acquainted since we found out we were related, I said.
I could see that fact go into their mental files.
Why y'all here? I asked. What did the anonymous caller say?
That you had a body buried in your woods.
Bud looked away as if he were a little ashamed to say something so outrageous, but I knew different. After years in law enforcement, Bud knew exactly what human beings could do, even the most normal-looking human beings, even young blondes with big boobs, maybe especially them.
You didn't bring any tracking dogs,
Claude observed. I was kind of hoping that Claude would keep his mouth shut, but I saw I wasn't going to get my wish.
I think a physical search will do it, Bud said. The location was real specific.
And the tracking dogs were expensive to hire, he thought.
Oh my gosh, I said, genuinely startled. How could this person claim not to be involved if they knew where the body was exactly? I don't get it.
I'd hoped Bud would tell me more, but he didn't bite. Andy shrugged.
We got to go look.
Look away,
I said, with absolute confidence. If they'd brought the dogs, I'd have been sweating bullets that they'd sent Debbie Pelt or the former resting site of Basim.
You'll excuse me if I just stay here in the house while you all tramp through the woods? I hope you don't pick up too many ticks.
Ticks lurked on bushes and weeds, sensing your chemicals and body heat as you passed, then making a leap of faith. I watched Andy tuck his pants into his boots, and Bud and Alcee sprayed themselves.
After the men had disappeared into the woods, Claude said,
"You'd better tell me why you're not scared."
"We moved the body last night," I said, and turned to sit down at the desk where I'd installed the computer I'd gotten from Hadley's apartment. Let Claude put that in his pipe and smoke it. After a few seconds, I heard him stomp back up the stairs. Since I had to wait for the men to come out of the woods, I might as well check my email. A lot of forwarded messages, most of them inspirational or patriotic, from Maxine Fortenberry, Hoyt's mother. I deleted those without reading them. I read an email from Andy Belfleur's pregnant wife, Hallie. It was a strange coincidence, hearing from her while her husband was out in the back of my house on a wild goose chase. Hallie told me she was feeling great, just great. But Grandmama Caroline was failing fast, and Hallie feared Miss Caroline wouldn't live to see her great-grandchild born. Caroline Belfleur was very old. Andy and Portia had been brought up in Miss Caroline's house after their parents had died. Miss Caroline had been a widow for longer than she'd been married. I had no memory of Mr. Belfleur at all, and I was pretty sure Portia and Andy hadn't known him that long. Andy was older than Portia, and Portia was a year older than me, so I estimated that Miss Caroline, who'd once been Renard Parrish's finest cook and had made the best chocolate cake in the world, was at least in her 90s.
"Anyway," Hallie went on, "she wants to find the family Bible more than anything else on this earth. You know she's always got a bee in her bonnet, and now it's finding that Bible, which has been missing for umpty-ump years. I had a wild thought. She thinks way back our family was connected to some branch of the Comptons. Would you ask your neighbor, Mr. Compton, if he would mind very much looking for that old Bible? It seems like a long shot, but she hasn't lost any of her personality, though she's physically weak."
That was a nice way of saying that Miss Caroline was bringing up that Bible real often. I was in a quandary. I knew that Bible was over at the Compton house, and I knew after she studied it, Miss Caroline would find out that she was a direct descendant of Bill Compton. How she'd feel about that was anybody's guess. Did I want to screw with her world view when the woman was on her deathbed? On the other hand, Oh, hell, I was tired of trying to balance everything out, and I had enough on my plate to worry about. In a reckless moment, I forwarded Hallie's email to Bill. I had come late to email, and I still didn't entirely trust it, but at least I felt I'd put the ball in Bill's court. If he chose to lob it back, well, okay. After I'd messed around a little on eBay, marveling at the things people were trying to sell, I heard voices in the front yard. I looked out to see Bud, Alcee, and Andy brushing dust and twigs off their clothes. Andy was rubbing at a bite on his neck. I went outside. "Did you find a body?" I asked them.
"No, we did not," Alcee Beck said. "We did see that people had been back there."
"Well, sure," I said, "but no body?"
"We won't trouble you any further," Bud said shortly.
They left in a cloud of dust. I watched them go and shivered. I felt like the guillotine had been descending on my neck and had been prevented from cutting off my head only because the rope was too short. I went back to the computer and sent Alcide an email. It said only, "The police were just here." I figured that would be enough. I knew I wouldn't hear from him until he was ready for me to come to Shreveport. I was surprised that it took 3 days to receive a reply from Bill. Those days had been remarkable only for the number of people I hadn't heard from. I hadn't heard from Remy, which wasn't too extraordinary. None of the members of the Longtooth Pack called, so I could only assume they'd retrieve the body of Basim from its new resting place and that they would let me know when the meeting would be held. If someone came into my woods and tried to find out why Basim's body had vanished, I didn't know about it. And I didn't hear from Pam or Bobby Burnham, which was a little worrisome, but still, no big. What did gripe me in a major way was not hearing from Eric. Okay, his maker, sire, dad, mentor, Appius Livius Okella was in town, but jeez Louise. In between sessions of worrying,
I looked up Roman names and found that Appius was his pre-nomen, his common name. Livius was his nomen, his family name, handed down from father to son, indicating that he was a member of the Livii family or clan. Ocala was his cognomen, so it was meant to indicate what particular branch of the Livii had borne him, or it could have been given as an honorific for his service in a war. I had no idea what war that could have been. As a third possibility, if he'd been adopted into another family, the cognomen would reflect his birth family. Your name said a lot about you in the Roman world. I wasted a lot of time finding out all about Appius Livius Ocella's name. I still had no idea what he wanted or what he intended to do to my boyfriend, and those were the things I needed to know the most. I have to say, I was feeling pretty sulky, pugnacious, and sullen. I looked up a few words while I was online. Not a pretty posy of emotions, but I couldn't seem to upgrade to dull unhappiness. Cousin Claude was making himself scarce, too. I glimpsed him only once in those 3 days, and that was when I heard him go through the kitchen and out the back door and got up in time to see him getting into his car. This goes to explain why I was delighted to see Bill at my back door when the sun had set on the 3rd day after I'd sent him Hallie's email. He was not looking appreciably better than he had the last time I'd seen him, but he was dressed in a suit and tie, and his hair was carefully combed. The Bible was under his arm. I understood why he was groomed, what he meant to do.
"Good," I said.
"Come with me," he said. "It will help if you're there."
"But they'll think..." And then I made my mouth shut. It was unworthy to be worrying about the Bellefleurs assuming Bill and I were a couple again when Caroline Bellefleur was about to meet her maker.
"Would that be so terrible?"
he asked with simple dignity.
"No, of course not. I was proud to be your girlfriend," I said, and turned to go back to my room.
"Please come in while I change clothes."
I'd finished the lunch and afternoon shift, and I changed to shorts and a t-shirt. Since I was in a hurry, I changed to an above-the-knee black skirt and a white cap-sleeve fitted blouse I'd gotten on sale at Stage. I slid a red leather belt through the belt loops and got some red sandals from the back of my closet. I fluffed my hair, and I was ready. I drove us over in my car, which was beginning to need an alignment. It wasn't a long ride to the Bellefleur mansion. It didn't take long to get anywhere in Bontemps. We parked in the driveway at the front door, but as we'd driven up, I glimpsed several cars in the back parking area. I'd seen Andy's car there, and Porsche's, too. There was an ancient gray Chevy Chevette parked sort of unobtrusively at the rear, and I wondered if Miss Caroline had a round-the-clock caregiver. We walked up to the double front doors. Bell didn't think it was appropriate. Seemly was the word he used, to go to the back, and under the circumstances I had to agree. Bell walked slowly and with effort. More than once, I wanted to offer to carry the heavy Bible, but I knew he wouldn't let me, so I saved my breath. Hallie answered the door, thank God. She was startled when she saw Bill, but she recovered her poise very quickly and greeted us.
"Hallie, Mr. Compton has brought the family Bible that Andy's grandmother wants to see," I said, in case Hallie had gone temporarily blind and hadn't noticed the huge volume.
Hallie was looking a little rough around the edges. Her brown hair was a mess, and her green-flowered dress looked almost as tired as her eyes. Presumably, she'd come over to Miss Caroline's after she'd worked all day teaching school. Hallie was obviously pregnant, something Bill hadn't known, I could tell by the fleeting expression on his face.
"Oh," Hallie said, her face visibly relaxing with relief. "Mr. Compton, please come in. You have no idea how Miss Caroline's fretted about this."
I think Hallie's reaction was a pretty good indicator of just how much Miss Caroline had fretted. We stepped into the entrance hall together. The wide flight of stairs was ahead of us and to our left. It curved gracefully up to the 2nd floor. Lots of local brides had had their pictures made on this staircase. I had come down it in heels and a long dress when I'd been a stand-in for a sick bridesmaid at Hallie and Andy's wedding.
"I think it would be real nice if Bill could give the Bible to Miss Caroline," I said, before the pause could become awkward. "There's a family connection." Even Hallie's excellent manners faltered.
Oh, how interesting.
Her back stiffened, and I saw Bill appreciating the curve of her pregnancy. A faint smile curved his lips for a second.
I'm sure that would be just fine, Hallie said, rallying. Let's just go upstairs.
We went up the stairs after her, and I had to struggle with the impulse to put a hand under Bill's elbow to help him a little. I would have to do something to help Bill. He obviously wasn't getting any better. A little fear crept into my heart. We walked a little farther along the gallery to the door to the largest bedroom, which was open a discreet few inches. Hallie stepped in ahead of us.
Sookie and Mr. Compton have brought the family Bible, she said. Miss Caroline, can he bring it in?
Yes, of course. Have him bring it, said a weak voice, and Bill and I walked in.
Miss Caroline was the queen of the room, no doubt about it. Andy and Portia were standing to the right of the bed, and they looked both worried and uneasy as Bill ushered me in. I noticed the absence of Portia's husband, Glenn. A middle-aged African-American woman was sitting in a chair to the left of the bed. She was wearing the bright, loose pants and cheerful tunic that nurses favored now. The pattern made her look as though she worked on a pediatric ward. However, in a room decorated in subdued peach and cream, the splash of color was welcome. The nurse was thin and tall and wore an incredible wig that reminded me of a movie Cleopatra. She nodded to us as we came closer to the bed. Caroline Bellefleur, who looked like the steel magnolia she was, lay propped up on a dozen pillows in the four-poster bed. There were shadows of exhaustion under her old eyes, and her hands curled in wrinkled claws on the bedspread, but there was still a flicker of interest in her eyes as she looked at us.
Miss Stackhouse, Mr. Compton, I haven't seen you since the big wedding, she said with an obvious effort. Her voice was thin as paper.
That was a beautiful occasion, Mrs. Bellefleur, Bill said with an almost equal effort.
I only nodded. This was not my conversation to have.
Please take a seat,
the old woman said, and Bill pulled a chair up closer to her bed. I sat a couple of feet back.
Looks like that Bible is too big for me to handle now, the ancient lady said with a smile. It was so nice of you to bring it over. I have sure been wanting to see it. Has it been in your attic? I know we don't have much connection with the Comptons, but I sure wanted to find that old book. Hallie was nice enough to do some checking for me.
As a matter of fact, this book was on my coffee table, Bill said gently. Mrs. Bellefleur, Caroline, my second child was a daughter, Sarah Isabel.
Oh, my goodness, said Miss Caroline, to indicate she was listening. She didn't seem to know where this was headed, but she was definitely attentive.
Though I didn't learn this until I read the family page in this Bible after I returned to Bon Ton, my daughter Sarah had four children, though one baby was born dead.
That happened so often back then, she said.
I glanced over at the Bellefleur grandchildren. Portia and Andy weren't happy that Bill was here, not at all, but they were listening, too. They hadn't spared a glance for me, which was actually just fine. Though they were puzzled by Bill's presence.